This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today on the show, it's Thursday. We'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. And Sue Balcom of the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan drops in to talk about one of our favorite subjects, food. And speaking of food, do you know anyone who grows it? Well, how about anyone who eats it? Well, then this next conversation impacts you. Mark Watney joins me in our Fargo studio. He is the president of the North Dakota Farmers Union, started in 1927 and now serving some 45,000 member families as a grassroots organization aimed at advancing family farms and ranches. We're going to talk about a recent trip to Russia. We're one of just a few people representing the entire ag system of America. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
And we are going to get to that trip to Russia, but we're going to start with what brings you to Fargo today, because the Farmers Union based in Jamestown, you are in Fargo today to talk about that behemoth omnibus bill that is the Agriculture Improvement Act of 2018, much more commonly known as the Farm Bill. Comes around every 5 years or so. There's so much volleying back and forth. It's the only time anybody talks about it, but boy, they talk about it a lot in that time. What is the North Dakota Farmers Union's position on this year's Farm Bill?
Well, we really think it's highly important that we get something done here in the near future. We need certainty in farm country, and lenders need certainty to be able to determine what the plans going forward will be, because we're in some tough times. The commodity prices are low, and that's where the Farm Bill plays the most important role. Keep in mind, it really is a consumer's bill. We have one of the greatest production systems in the country, or in the world, I should say. And due to the fact that there's been a good Farm Bill, there's been good planning, and throughout the years, that's been what's kept the farmers on the land. And that is very key to continuing this tremendous food system where consumers only pay about 7% of their disposable income for their food in the U.S., which is the lowest in the world.
That is pretty low, 7%. But the position of the Farmers Union, are you in support of this bill? What would you like to see changed? I know that there are, you know, the House version failed in May. The Senate Ag Committee passed it yesterday, so there are still some hurdles to overcome here. But generally, how are you feeling about the
bill? We are pretty happy with the Senate bill. It took care of a lot of things that we were concerned about. We believe in the current political climate that this may be as good as we can probably get. We would actually like to see reference prices in the PLC program go up. That's a better safety net.
And the PLC program?
Yeah. It's where you put either PLC or ARC, and the PLC program has target or reference prices that if the commodity prices drop below a certain level, then the farmers get some difference from the government to help offset those costs. We'd like to see those reference prices closer to the cost of production. They're, again, a more stable type of support level if prices are low. The ARC program tends to follow those prices down, and so the backstop that you have from ARC is a little bit less.
Okay. So it takes some of the risk out of farming for farmers to have those prices set where the Farmers Union would like them set?
It definitely does. And, okay. Keep in mind that we're still selling a lot of our commodities for prices that were in the 60s, sometimes in the 70s. We haven't seen really much increase. So having that backstop that reflects the cost of production. So right now, the farmer's only way to make money is to become extremely efficient on a cost analysis basis or to produce more. Well, if we produce more, we drive the prices lower. So there's a kind of a catch-22. So the Farm Bill becomes that backstop. That with the crop insurance is key. And then, of course, there's some conservation, there's rural development, and there's other programs that benefit farming and benefit the environment that we support also.
You said you're mostly happy with the Senate version. What are your thoughts on the House version that did fail?
The House version tried to do some things that we didn't really like. One is with the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Program. And, I understand what they're trying to do, and a lot of people question why they're together, but this is how D.C. works. They put large projects together, whether it's infrastructure or overall budget, and then they pass them. That's just the way the system works.
So they can get broad support.
Broad support. And okay. If you don't put supplemental nutrition in there with basically this is a food security bill. Mm-hmm. It's about the nation's food supply. You're leaving out the folks that need that assistance. And we thought that if you – take too many dollars away from that, that there's no way you'll get the urban legislator to support it and we won't get a farm bill. Again, farmers are about feeding people, and we support feeding the folks that need a little bit of help at times.
Mm-hmm. What do the farmers get out of this bill? You mentioned, of course, some of that price regulation, but what else is there? The crop insurance.
The crop insurance is what most farmers think is the most key. Again, that gives us the tool so that we can borrow capital and have the ability to pay our operating money back if something happens. And there's a lot of things in agriculture that's a little unique. You know, you can have some damage to other businesses, but it's a lot more likely that you would have weather damages to a farm or to a crop. So we need that support system. And it really does. It comes in and picks us up at maybe a 70 or 75% coverage level that we can buy. Mm-hmm. And it makes us whole or at least close to whole so we can go into the next year.
Opponents of this part of the farm bill, the crop insurance and the subsidies, sometimes call it corporate welfare and saying it's because half the payments go to the farmers making north of $100,000 annually. And then also some concerns about covering crops that aren't things that humans eat. We're talking about ethanol or feed corn or cotton. What is your response to that criticism?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where we support a concept of payment limits and targeting. So you could fix some of that if you do a little bit more work on that. That's not always everything acceptable. But any program you put out there, there will be some folks that will be seen as abusing it. That's just a symptom of trying to do good legislation. So we could fix that. We could do based on Social Security numbers. We could limit those payments. We could cover that and fix it so people were less concerned about money going to too many. Now, on the other hand, if you look at what we're doing for food production in comparison to the rest of the world, we're only spending on the farm portion of it 0.28% of our budget goes to the commodity titles, goes to conservation, and goes to crop insurance. For 0.28% of the whole federal budget to have the food production system we have today and the consumer-only spending 7% of their disposable income, the lowest in the world, that seems like a really, really minimal investment.
Should food be more expensive? Some people would argue, you know, you take care of a car that costs more than a junker.
Well, you know, if I was living in a true free market system, if there was such a thing, I mean, that's what the way farmers would tend to make money is you would hopefully get paid more from the marketplace. But food is an essential item. So, you know, obviously air and water are first. I mean, we can't live very long with either one of those, not having either one of those. And then, of course, food's next. And sometimes we forget that because we've had such an abundant food supply that, you know, we just think you go to the grocery store and you buy it. Mm-hmm. And there's endless choice. So I think in the interest of the economy, in the interest of a nation, it's good that food is at a lower cost. But when it comes at the cost of farmers being able to make money, it bothers me.
Another major facet of the Farm Bill is the environmental protections. Just for anyone who isn't familiar with that, what are some of the environmental protections included in the Farm Bill?
So keep in mind, we support family farm agriculture, and family farmers tend to be generational farmers, which means they're going to take care of their soil so that next generation can continue to produce food. So we support that. Now, when you add conservation, what it is it's generally programs that enable farmers to do certain practices and then get somewhat of a carrot instead of a stick approach. There's both approaches. You know, if you don't do things properly, you can get some penalty and fines. You know, if you drain some wetlands or if you're farming highly erodible soil, there is some punishment that you can't sign up for farm programs. But on the other side, there's programs like EQIP, and there was other areas where if you do certain additional practices from the norm, you can get some payments. And then, of course, CRP falls in that where we actually take some land out of production.
That's
to
the Conservation Reserve Program.
Okay. And then you bid that in at some level of payment per acre. We're supportive of all the conservation. We really want it, though, to be about the carrot side where farmers are preserving things. They should get paid for it. And that's healthy. But never forget, most family farms are pretty darn good stewards.
Yeah.
Now, there's exceptions to every rule. I mean, I see pictures once in a while of things that didn't go quite right. But it's never in the plan. You know, you can't plan for a 4-inch rainfall. I mean, there's things you just can't plan for. But we're getting better. We don't work the ground as much. We're planting more grasslands. We're putting some buffers and barriers and stuff. So we're doing better on all that. But I will still fall back that typically the farmer is a true steward and does a really good job on the land.
So are those protections, generally speaking, in place then because of big ag and agribusiness kind of concerns?
They are. And, you know, if you're going to be part of the farm program, if you're going to play in crop insurance, you have certain guidelines with draining of wetlands and or moving water and or farming hydrogen. So those things are in place. Now, if you step outside of that program and don't accept any payments, you really can get back to do what you want in some respects. So, but I think 97-98% of the farmers in North Dakota sign up for the farm programs.
What is the Farmers Union doing in terms of working with Senators Heitkamp and Hoven and Representative Kramer on this specific bill?
So we've had a little bit more work with the senators simply because it was done a little bit more open than the House bill was. So I've been in contact with them probably 2-3 times here in the last couple of days where we're trying to get and help them with certain amendments. We supported Senator Hoven on an amendment that indicated that we could raise some of the lending authority through FSA for on a per farm basis, which would help young producers and be more reflective of the needs of the capital for farmers. We've been working with Hoven on a few amendments, on Senator Heitkamp with a few amendments. They're calling us to see what we support and what we don't support, what they might consider changing. Of course, it came out of the committee now and it passed. So now the question is how many amendments will be allowed on the floor? And if we can get something offered up, we will. And, of course, if they have ideas for us, we'll support them.
So where does the Farmers Union go from here? Is there any more ability to do the input, or do you need to hear from your 45,000 member families? You know, or is it at this point it's out of anyone's
hands? Well, no, we've actually got a plan. Now, the hard thing on a plan is we don't know what the House will do. So if we make the assumption the Senate passes it before they leave for the July recess, and if we assume the House gets something out maybe right before or after, then they go to conference committee. So that's when we need to step up and say we prefer these things in this bill. So if we like the Senate better, we'll work that. If we like the House better, we work that. Mm-hmm. But we have a plan because we don't think it's going to get done timely. We have a plan. We're taking about 100 people out to D.C. in September. And we're going to do a hard push then to get it wrapped up. We're thinking it might run till the end of September before they get it done, and we're going to be out there pushing real hard to get it done.
You've been active with the Farmers Union for some time now. How does your experience with the 2018 Farm Bill compare to versions in the past? It feels like every time the Farm Bill comes around that this is the craziest version ever with all sorts of weird strings attached. Yeah. But then I go back and think, oh, well, I said that last time too.
Well, we've always been able to get a major role. Typically, though, this has been different. Typically, we've been able to sit down with some of the commodity organizations and some of the other farm organizations and come together on the areas we agree. And we'd sit with FSA folks and we'd sit with leadership of all whoever was elected at the time and discuss it. And then there'd be quite a bit more hearings where we'd go and give input. This one we've been at our senators and at Kramer come out. We did a little bit of that work, but there hasn't been as much time for input. The House bill was written quite a bit behind scenes and then just rolled out with very, very little window to have input. The Senate bill was less behind scenes with a little more input, but it was rolled out. So now our choice is just the amendments and getting somebody to put the amendments forward. So I would say it's been a little more shut door, closed door than in the past. And I think that's primarily because the assumption was it's going to look a lot the same as it did before with tweaks. And that's probably what we're seeing in the Senate bill. The House took a little more aggressive approach to cutting SNAP, which I really don't think is acceptable.
That does help some 41 million low-income Americans. And SNAP, for anyone who's not familiar, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We are visiting with Mark Watney. He is the president of the North Dakota Farmers Union. And you are recently back from Russia, where you were speaking to the World Farmers Organization. Is it really only three Americans who were there?
There was three people representing. So there's about 80 countries.
Okay.
And they each send a delegation. A lot of times it's only one or two people. So even though it's a large organization in countries that participate representing farmers, mm-hmm. The people that tend to go there, it's usually two or three. So we're looking at probably a couple hundred people that show up for this.
So what were you doing there?
So the WFO is, again, 80 countries, and we're the true voice of farmers. Many times when there's a world farm meetings, there's not a necessary farmer representative group. It'll be agribusiness, or it'll be government, or it'll be other folks that tend to talk. This organization is the one that truly represents farmers, and we're always trying to get our policies put forward. So what we do is we try to figure out how we can make small farms or family farms, they call it small farms in that world, how we make them successful across the world in this so-called global economy that we have to compete in. So we're always looking for, you know, in trade, we're looking for things that raise prices, not lower prices. We're always looking for crop insurance programs. We're always wanting to be part of the discussions at the United Nations and with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. And so when it comes to chemicals, trade, GMOs, all that stuff, we're trying to develop language that the world farmers can support.
So this is potentially impacting policy decisions?
Well, it has the impact of us putting out policies that we can agree upon that could be. And in the United Nations, yes, it definitely could. Now, whether or not we can get that back to like the United States or into the European Union or into the Asian markets, whether they'll change theirs for it, all we can do is suggest. So,
do you follow trends in other countries and perhaps try to implement them here in North Dakota?
We do. There are some really good things that happen in other countries. Of course, a lot of people want to follow our lead. You know, we still are basically family farms here. And with our great success story and our production story, a lot of people want to duplicate that because they want their country to be self-sufficient as we are. So we do. I did a report on crop insurance, and I did a report on data storage as a big issue for farmers. A lot of the underdeveloped countries don't quite get the value of all that stuff at this point in time. They may get it, but they're not necessarily protecting it. So
what
it comes
is the value
question.
Of that?
Endless. I mean, it's very endless. I mean, that's going to be the next thing that farmers need to own, and they need to keep it under control, is the data they're collecting, because that'll have high value, something we really got to think about.
And when you say data collecting, are you talking what kinds of crops?
Mapping,
or are you talking who's buying their food?
Or? No, I'm talking the soil mapping, the yields, the types of varieties, the seed placement, the products you apply, the rainfall. The yields, all that stuff that gets layered upon each other in maps to determine how we provide for the world as this population grows and the energy needs that you mentioned earlier.
All right, Mark, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Perfect.
Mark Watney is the president of the North Dakota Farmers Union. Coming up next on Main Street, we have a story on the shortage of rural veterinarians, and that comes to us from Harvest Public Media.
The 28th Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival will be held at the Cross Ranch State Park on Friday and Saturday, June 15th and 16th, featuring Monroe Crossing from Minneapolis and North Country Bluegrass from the Seattle area, and of course, festival host Cottonwood and much more. You can bring your instruments for a bluegrass workshop on Saturday or enjoy the scenic walking trails of Cross Ranch State Park. More information is available by calling 701-794-3731 or at cottonwoodbluegrass.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In rural towns across America, there is a shortage of veterinarians. The pay is low, the hours are long, and not many of these professionals want to live in towns where people are outnumbered by cattle. But as Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, a lack of veterinarians leaves farmers and our food supply vulnerable to outbreaks.
Inside a sun-soaked barn, Dr. Karen Chandler visits with her first patient of the morning. Well, actually, there are 38 of them. These newborn calves are here for their first checkup. One by one, the calves are restrained and lifted onto a metal table. First, they're vaccinated, then they're branded with a hot iron. Chandler, a large animal vet, castrates the male calves.
they're going to be fine. They'll be a little sore, but they'll be back with mom and they'll be nursing in 20 minutes and they'll be fine.
This is what preventive medicine looks like for cows. And Chandler says it benefits more than just the animal and farmer.
Everything we do for our cattle is for the promotion of happy, healthy cattle. And that ends up with happy, healthy people.
In the rural town of Brush, Colorado, Chandler is the first line of defense against diseases that can spread from animals to humans. It's her job to identify and report potential outbreaks to public health officials before they become devastating. Like back in 2015, when the bird flu led to the deaths of 50 million turkeys and chickens. That's why an increasing shortage in rural vets concerns experts like Mark Stetter, the dean at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Colorado State University.
If those individuals are not out looking at a sick cow or testing animals as they're being shipped from one area to the other, we obviously run a real risk to our food chain, to our human health, and to our animal health.
In 2017, the U.S. Department of Agriculture identified nearly 200 mostly rural areas with insufficient access to a veterinarian. Stetter says the scarcity of rural vets looks nearly identical to the country's shortage of rural doctors. For one, rural wages can't keep up with hefty student loans. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, veterinarians in rural areas earn between $60,000 to $70,000 a year, half of what they could make in a city. That's not a lot to live off when the average debt for vet school is over $140,000. Stetter says about 30% of students accepted into its program are interested in working in rural areas. But after graduation, less than 10% will take a rural job. And those students are thinking about one thing.
You know what? I have a pretty big debt as I walk out the door, and I actually can't afford to work in rural areas because of that debt.
Chandler is the first to admit that she and her husband could not have come to Brush had she not been accepted for a highly competitive loan forgiveness program from the USDA.
I would say most of the time we can budget money well, and we can figure out how to handle debt. I don't have a lot of things that other people have, but I have a really good life.
She says the job comes with other sacrifices, like the lack of good Italian in rural Colorado. There's also the long days and odd hours.
Horses colic in the middle of the night. Pigs get born at 6 a.m. and you can't get your kids to school on time.
Chandler's white pickup doubles as her mobile clinic. She'll travel hours to answer house calls for clients like Kim Davis, who drives hundreds of cattle in the most remote corners of the Eastern Plains. When a heifer needs an emergency C-section or a horse has a broken leg, Davis has to have a vet that can reach her within the hour.
It's trying to think of the right word. It's absolutely vital.
But when help is too far away, a phone call to the vet can be just as good, especially when it comes to preventing diseases among herds of cattle.
Sometimes the neighbors will get weird diseases, and we're trying to stay away from that. We're going, okay, here's the symptoms. What are you thinking this is, and what can we do to prevent from getting it?
One dead cow can set a rancher back thousands of dollars. But Chandler says working with livestock is about more than a bottom line. Like when she inspects cattle before they're sold for slaughter.
Every day that I'm out here at the sale barn on Thursday mornings, my thought is, would I want my niece to eat this at school? Mm-hmm. And if I don't think I'd want my niece to eat that at school, it doesn't walk through our sale ring.
There's a sense of stewardship for the animals and society. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collective focusing on food, fuel, and field. Still to come on Main Street, gardening tips from Sue Balcom. But now, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. While most of North Dakota could be trapped in hot, humid conditions today, National Weather Service forecasters say they may also there may also be a need to be watchful for severe thunderstorms in some areas. Alex Edwards is a meteorologist with the Bismarck National Weather Service.
Along and north of Highway 2, I'd say that's the greatest risk for those storms with large hail, damaging winds. Any storm that forms will definitely have some torrential rainfall with it. And then as you go further south, the confidence is a little less likely.
Edwards says a cap or a layer of warm air has moved in from the Rockies and will make it tougher for the severe weather to break farther south. With that being said,
but we're expecting a second area of storms across the south, and that will be more likely an area of more damaging winds as the likely threat instead of large hail. There'll still be a threat for hail, but it'll be more of a wind threat there. And then kind of in the middle towards Bismarck, you know, we'll have to see if something forms. We could still see that hail threat, that wind threat, but it's a little more likely to our north, up toward Minot and that area.
Edwards says for the northeast corner of the state, the potential for heavy rainfall may not be as welcome. He says June has so far been a wet month for that region. Edwards says additional moisture at this point may be too much of a good thing in some areas. Pre-cut melons are the cause of a multi-state salmonella outbreak that's sickened 60 people in the Midwest. Anna Yakutenko reports for Harvest Public Media that the outbreak has already spurred a lawsuit.
The widespread recall involves cut watermelons, honeydew, cantaloupe, and mixed fruit in 9 states that were sold at retailers like Walmart, Costco, and Whole Foods. Indiana-based melon supplier Cata Foods voluntarily issued the recall, but is being sued by food safety law firm Marler Clark. Salmonella causes diarrhea, fever, and abdominal cramps. People usually recover without treatment after a few days. Dana Hawkinson is an infectious disease physician with the University of Kansas City Health System. He says it's impossible to see the contamination.
Always, you know, try to wash your fruits and vegetables. Otherwise, make sure you're cleaning your utensils in between cutting meats and raw chicken and things like that and using it for other things.
The Food and Drug Administration is investigating the outbreak. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Anna Yakutenko.
And a pool of mosquitoes collected in Grand Forks has been identified as having West Nile virus, and Todd Hansen of Grand Forks Mosquito Control says it's believed to be the first such identification in North Dakota this year. Hansen says the most common mosquito transmitting the virus is most active just before sundown and throughout the night into early morning hours.
We don't have a lot of nuisance mosquitoes right now. I think that'll change within the next week with the rain that we have. But so we don't want people to let their guard down thinking that, you know, there's no mosquitoes out there right now, so I don't have to worry about it.
Hansen says citizens should take extra precautions to avoid being bitten. He suggests eliminating standing water around homes that might be a breeding ground for mosquitoes.
Anything that holds water for up to a week could potentially raise mosquitoes. And these type of mosquitoes, when they hatch out, they stay close to the area that they hatched from. You want to eliminate any breeding sites around your own property.
North Dakota had 62 human cases of West Nile last year. 2 of those cases were fatal. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. 2018 is the 100th anniversary of Willa Cather's novel, My Antonia, the third, and some say best, in her Prairie Trilogy books. Historian Tom Ezern reflects on a scene in this week's Plainsfolk essay.
It is a literary episode so vibrant, so sensate, as to compel the reader to lay aside the text and let it sink in. Jim Burden, the ambivalent narrator of Willa Cather's My Antonia, has come to the Cusack farm to look up Antonia following a lapse of decades. There is the reunion in the kitchen and the gathering of the curious children, whereupon Antonia's able daughter, Anna, suggests, "Why don't we show Mr. Burden our new fruit cave?" Out from the farmhouse they troop, the children at our heels, Jim recounts. When we descended, they all came down after us, and the boys seemed quite as proud of the cave as the girls were. The cellar was chock full, not only with symbolism, but also with the abundance of the land. There were barrels of cucumber and watermelon pickles, and there were shelves stacked with glass jars exhibiting cherries and strawberries and crabapples, and, of course, the spiced plums with which Antonia topped her kolache. As the boys murmur behind his back, Jim turns on them to say, "You think I don't know what kolaches are, eh? You're mistaken, young man. I've eaten your mother's kolaches long before that Easter day when you were born." The first week of June, we ate a few kolache ourselves in Red Cloud, Nebraska, the town known as Blackhawk in Cather's novel. There was a great gathering of Cather scholars and aficionados to celebrate the publication centenary of My Antonia. The outpouring of scholarship, enthusiasm, and fellowship was heartening. The proceedings, hosted by the Willa Cather Foundation, centered on the Red Cloud Opera House, the very place where young Willa delivered her commencement address in 1890. There's great work being done in Red Cloud to foster heritage tourism powered by literary pilgrimage. We were among the Kolanchi-munching literati in attendance, hanging on every word, but at the same time anticipating the final day, when the meeting would adjourn to the Bavelka farmstead near Blodden. There, we were to be hosted by the descendants of Anna Sadlec Pavelka, the Bohemian immigrant prototype for Cather's fictional character of Antonia. When the time came, of course, the fruit cellar was the focus of affectionate attention. Children of the Pavelka clan assembled to reenact the pell-mell descent into the ground, which they rendered with enthusiasm. It is truly an impressive cave, brick-walled with a vaulted ceiling. I paced it, 6 feet by 16, with a ceiling height of 7 feet, the top of which was a good 6 feet underground. Now at home this afternoon, I reread the reunion passages from My Antonia and visualize the hollyhocks alongside the farmhouse, the grape arbors, the well-tended orchard, and the mulberry hedge that saved the cherries from the birds. I scent with Cather the dewy sunflowers and the ironweed while the boys milk the cows. These things I ponder as I settle into my own garden at dusk to pluck the pigweed and quackgrass from my onion rows. We've had a good rain, and I have to stay on top of these things. I appreciate the soras and the ringnecks calling from the creek bottom. Await the contributions of our neighborhood coyotes. And I think about digging a deep, deep cellar.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up next on Main Street, Doug Hamilton and I talk with Sue Balcom to get gardening tips for this time of year.
My father believed any man that needed a vacation should get a different job. For him, those 110 acres was the whole world. He needed nothing else.
Hi, this is Dave Isay, founder of the Public Radio Oral History Project StoryCorps. Remember an important person in your life when our mobile recording booth comes to town.
StoryCorps will be at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck, June 28th through July 27th. To make a reservation, go to prairiepublic.org or call 1-800-850-4406. Sponsored in part by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and joining us from our studio in Bismarck, Sue Balcom with the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this beautiful month of June.
You sent an essay to us, and it's called Farmers Are the Most Impatient, Patient Folks You'll Ever Meet.
Oh, and this is an exciting time of year for farmers. But while most people who don't garden don't realize that the race starts back in December, you know, we're thinking about gardening when the seed catalogs start to arrive in December, and we're paging through them just like we used to go through that Sears and Roebuck catalog when we were kids. Oh, let's try this. Oh, let's try that. There's a never, ever, ever enough space for all those wonderful plants. So we have to make decisions. And then, of course, we get to order. And we don't order from just one company, because what would be the point of that? Then you wouldn't get all those great catalogs, right? So we order from this company and that company, and we really do stand by some of our favorite varieties. You know, there's a special cabbage that I grow for sauerkraut, and there's special cucumbers I grow for making pickles. But, oh, my gosh, those beautiful pictures are so tempting that you have to always try something new, whether it's a blue tomato or, you know, some storage cabbage or, you know, something curious that you'd love to see grown in your garden.
So what is Sue Balcom growing at the Root Cellars Farm?
Oh, my gosh. I have my entire garden in. It's awesome. My cucumbers are like 4 inches tall. I have potatoes. They're just beautiful. We have tomatoes and peppers and lots of dill. For some reason, I should have maybe cleaned my garden out a little better last year because my whole ground is fuzzy with dill in one of my beds. I'm like, whoa. What else is out there? Peas. My peas are doing really well because they like cold weather. And, of course, garlic, which is planted in October, is you know, really, really doing well this time of year.
Well, you're a serious gardener, obviously, because you sell some of your produce. And lots of people are less serious about it. But what's your routine? What has to happen every day?
Well, I would like to every day just be laying on the grass next to my garden watching it grow. But you must prep first, okay? So this time of year, you know, you can plant cold weather crops in April in North Dakota, but you should never, ever take the chance of planting tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers before you're absolutely certain it's not going to freeze. So once you get everything in the ground, which we are past our frost date, but we have been having some weird weather lately, mm-hmm. You want to water and weed and water and weed. And once your vegetables get stronger than the weeds, you can kind of back off a little bit. So, you know, you get everything going and you work really, really hard for a couple of weeks and then, bam, you can sit and watch the things grow.
Is that roughly where you're at now in you know, June?
Yep. Yep. In fact, my weeds aren't quite prolific enough yet to pull. So I'm watching things like, you know, carrot seeds are really tiny and radish seeds and stuff. And you want to keep those little seeds wet all the time. Because if they dry out, they may not germinate for you. And another thing that we can do this time of year, once your tomatoes and all those bedding plants are in, then we collect grass clippings, of course, chemical-free grass clippings and or straw or paper, and we go around and mulch. We don't mulch immediately. We give them a week or two to get established, and then you can start laying down some mulch, which will also help keep the weeds away from your peppers and tomatoes.
Well, we have supermarkets, Sue, and I think that insects and birds and animals have gardens. So how do you deal with that?
With insects? Well, there aren't any insects where I'm at right at the moment, but plants, the best way to plant a garden is to kind of diversify your crops a little bit. You know, like I have tomatoes planted in several different areas and cabbages in several different areas because that confuses pests. But pests are also vital to the development of your tomatoes and peppers and things because, like people, they develop an immunity to these things. And so you don't want some pest coming in and ravishing anything, but you can confuse them with other kinds of varieties planted around certain beds. But the immunity that a plant develops when it has to be stressed a little bit, whether it's stressed from drought or stressed from insects, that translates into better nutrients in your actual fruit. So if your tomato is really strong and powerful, then the tomatoes that you eat will also provide some of that to you as a person.
Hmm. What about when it comes to that time in the garden when it is time to thin stuff out? Like you mentioned, carrot seeds are so tiny, you can't possibly plant one in a hole. You just, you know, 100 fall out and you can't hardly tell.
It's called broadcasting, and I love broadcasting seed because that's right? Way easier, right, than sprinkling. That's why microgreens are so much fun because those are broadcast. But what I do, and I read this book a long time ago called, it was written by Ruth Stout, and she talked about how to be a lazy gardener, and she's big on mulch, but she also suggested that once your carrots get up to about the, you know, when you can start seeing their fuzzy leaves, you just kind of get down on the ground with the manicure scissors and you clip between those carrots. And I'm not kidding you. You can eat that stuff if you want or just let it lay there. But then you're not disturbing the roots that are already solid in the ground. And it's kind of fun to do. And you can clip weeds like that also with a little manicure scissors. But, you know, the most common thing I hear from people when they ask me about gardening is, I just can't grow radishes. I can't grow carrots. I don't know what's wrong with me. And it's because they don't thin them out. It's a painful process, but it only has to be done, like right now, it has to be done critically well. But then when the plants start getting a little bit bigger so that you can grab them with your fingers, you can eat those little carrots as you're out there thinning. So that's a bonus.
Yeah. Don't have to buy that bag of them.
Right.
That have actually been, I think, sort of chiseled down to that size.
Right. That's what they do. They kind of tumble those things. They're really full-size carrots. But my husband's always wondering why we never have turnips in the house. And I said, well, they never make it past the thinning stage. Oh, shoot.
June 17th is Eat All Your Veggies Day.
Well, that's an absolutely good practice to get into all the days of the year, but June 17th just happened to be Eat All Your Veggies Day. And the guys at the federal USDA suggest that you get at least 2 to 3 cups of vegetables daily. And some people are like, oh, I can't eat that many vegetables. But really, if you have a nice, good-sized salad with a good, healthy oil and vinaigrette dressing on there, you know, 2 cups of leafy greens and a order of beans or peas on the side, and you can do it. I know you can. And if you don't want to grow your own vegetables and go through all what people perceive to be work, is farmers markets will be starting up very soon, the end of June or the beginning of July. So you could do yourself a favor, eat those 5 servings of vegetables, and support your local farmers markets at the same time.
Like the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan. We check in with Sue Belcom regularly. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Hey, thank you, guys.
And the doctor looked at my dad, and he said, what was the joke? So my dad starts laughing so hard that he got woozy. So the doctor said, well, we need to run some tests because that's not normal.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This week, stories about fathers and father figures. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And there is that all-important question we ask ourselves once a week. What is going on? And we are going to answer that now on Main Street. And I am in studio now with Seth Habhegger. And he is a master control operator here at Prairie Public and a former radio intern and the man responsible for putting together this calendar every week. Seth, we appreciate you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, what events you got for us?
I think my first event would be a film they'll be showing in Washburn on Friday, June 15th. It's Men's Roles in Mandan Society. Mm. Kelvin Grinnell, tribal historian for the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, will present his short film, Men's Roles in Mandan Society. The film explores the duties and positions of Mandan men. A question and answer portion will follow the film. And the cost is $8. That is at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center, Fort Mandan.
There is going to be a water media exhibition reception coming up on Tuesday the 19th in Moorhead at the YumCom Center. In fact, this is the 25th annual National Juried Water Media Exhibition going on. The display is June 18th through August 4th with sort of a reception on Tuesday the 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. And there's going to be refreshments, remarks, awards, what have you. You are welcome to attend this, and this is put on by the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County. Again, the reception Tuesday the 19th, beginning at 4 p.m. The exhibit is on display June 18th through August 4th, and the cost to go to the reception is free.
For those of you who are entomologically inclined,
aren't we all?
There is a Firefly Wonder Walk at Fergus Falls this Saturday, June 16th. Taking place at the Prairie Wetlands Learning Center. The public is invited to take a summer walk on the prairie to view the enchanted blinking lights of fireflies, a.k.a. lightning bugs. Search for different colors, patterns, and behaviors. Examine a firefly and its lantern up close. Try your skill at imitating its flashing pattern. Visitors will meet at the visitor center on the deck. After a brief introduction, they will take a walk and explore the prairie and wetlands for glowing fireflies. That takes place at 10 p.m., and it is free.
Coming up this Sunday in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum, battlefields, blitzkrieg, and bombs. And this is part of their Sensational Sundays program. They do this periodically in Bismarck where they have lots of interesting information and presentations. And these are at 2 o'clock at the Heritage Museum in Bismarck. And this is going to be talking about the different campaigns and battles of World War I and World War II. You can learn about some of the strategy, the tactics, the troop movements, and what some of the goals behind the war actually were, and the reasons behind victory and defeat. They're also going to take a look at that at battlefields, blitzkrieg, and bombs this Sunday in Bismarck at the Heritage Center at 2 o'clock as part of their Sensational Sundays programming, and it's free.
The Fargo Public Library is having a talent show. Do you juggle, do magic tricks, play an instrument, dance,
no,
sing,
no,
do gymnastics?
No.
Or have another talent you would like to show off to the community?
No.
Area kids and teens with a competitive spirit can show off their talents at the Fargo Public Library's talent show. Geared for children in grades 1 through 12, you're off the hook. The talent show is scheduled for Tuesday, June 19th at 6:30 p.m. at the main library. Performers will be judged on quality and presentation, with prizes awarded for various age categories. All types of talents are welcome, but please register by Monday, June 18th.
All right, I'm going to stay in libraries, but head over to Minot. Coming up tomorrow, June 15th, there is a T-shirt design workshop, and this is at the Minot Public Library. They have a maker space there, and you can custom make your own T-shirt with a die-cutting machine and a heat transfer vinyl. So that's sort of like those iron-on patches, except they're made out of vinyl. This is a free event open to people 12 and up. Bring your own cotton T-shirt. You know, limit the patterns on there because you're going to want to showcase your own pattern that you are creating with these machines.
Any color. Could be fuchsia.
Yeah, that's an excellent color. I like it. 4:30 on Friday, the 15th in Minot at the Minot Public Library. And it's free. But again, bring your own shirt. Do you have a pick of the week, Seth?
I do.
All right, let's hear it.
North Dakota Shakespeare takes place in Grand Forks at the town square Thursday through Sunday, the 14th through the 17th. Join professional theater artists from all over the country as they present William Shakespeare's 12th Night. Following a shipwreck, twins Viola and Sebastian are separated. With the help of new friends and new loves, they pave their way in a foreign land filled with mischief, mayhem, and mistaken identity. This well-loved comedy is sure to please audience members of all ages. Rated PG. Takes place 7 o'clock on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 2 p.m. on Sunday, and it's free.
All right, and my pick of the week, well, there is a holiday this weekend. Get out there and celebrate dads. And if you are one, just be celebrated.
That'll be nice. I would appreciate being celebrated for once.
We all know a lot of dads who are just hardworking and stoic and mean so much to our families. So take a moment to say thanks to any of the dads or dad-like figures in your life. That's what's happening. Dakota Datebook is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll spend the full half hour with North Dakota businessman and entrepreneur Gary Theraldson. A new book by Patrick McCloskey about his life is called Open Secrets of Success, The Gary Theraldson Story. We'll talk with Gary next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for June 14th. The Marquis de Moors already had one heck of a personal story before he broke a bottle of wine on a tent stake and christened the town of Medora in the Dakota Badlands. He was a French aristocrat born into a noble military family with Spanish lineage, dating back to the conquest of Sardinia in the 13th century. His family also had vague connections to French royalty.
On this date in 1858, Antoine Amédée Marie Vincent Manca Amat de Vallombrosa was born in an old house of his mother's family in a historic district of Paris. He would become the Marquis de Mors et de Monte Maggiore, the Emperor of the Badlands. He was a highly sensitive and imaginative boy who, by age 10, had already learned French, English, Italian, and German. He had the best tutors and education, which included catechism. He was a brilliant student and attended Stanislaus College in Caen, where he graduated in 1873. He wanted to enter the Navy, but became sick and couldn't complete the tests. He then entered a Jesuit college, where he also excelled, and after graduation, he entered a military academy. The Marquis was crafty and prone to pulling pranks, but nevertheless he graduated in 1879 at age 21 and went to France's premier cavalry school to train to become an officer. He was a natural horseman and superb with swords and pistol. He was a skilled duelist and killed two opponents by 1882. The Marquis had a few brief posts and even saw some action in quelling an uprising in Algiers. He was promoted to first lieutenant, returned to duty in provincial towns, but boredom crept in. He resigned in 1882, but kept a reserve commission. His social standing brought him across the path of Medora von Hoffman, who was the daughter of a New York banker. They married a year before the wily Marquis set foot in what would become Medora, North Dakota. His time in Dakota was largely marked by failure, including his ambitious meatpacking operation and his stagecoach line to Deadwood. That crazy Frenchman wasn't popular with local cowboys, and even after he left Dakota for Paris in 1887, the Marquis continued his ambitious streak with plans for an Indochinese railroad and ultimately a political quest across North Africa that ended with his assassination. A fortune teller had predicted his demise. "You are going on a long voyage. You will not return." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
President Trump says North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un loves his people. Don't tell that to a North Korean who was evicted from the capital because his father said the wrong word.
Kim Jong-un, if he loved me, he would listen. But he doesn't love his people. He loves his power.
Also, Paul Manafort returns to court on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, normally on Fridays we would hear from news director Dave Thompson, but he is out of the office on vacation, so we are going to visit with Kara Hetland. She is the director of radio for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and she is going to update us on what's going on in the state, including the recent primary held in South Dakota that included changes in the amendment to Marcy's Law. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.